The first issue I'm going to be very brief about, because there's a far more important issue in this case, and that's the issue of that the government takes the position that you can never have an effective assistance of counsel or counsel fail to move to suppress under Fourth Amendment grounds because it's not the evidence that would be excluded is not necessarily making the case unreliable, and I'll get to that in a moment. But in this case, very simply, why the trial judge is wrong in not giving an evidentiary hearing is if you look at page 7 of my brief, there are a number of paragraphs which were set out in the defendant's affidavit, which clearly demonstrate, under his version of facts, that the entry into the apartment violated his Fourth Amendment rights. The government said, well, he didn't say he was forced to let them enter. Doesn't have to. If I open my door to somebody and I stand there at the threshold and they're agents and they walk into my house and they don't have to use any force other than, you know, walking, that's a violation of my Fourth Amendment rights. It's my house. And two, so the defendant says that they are invited. The government agents at the preliminary hearing said, well, he invited us. That's the conflict of fact. That conflict of fact requires an evidentiary hearing. What the trial judge said, she said, well, he consented, so it makes no difference if they entered illegally or not. She cited this court's opinion in Valencia as the court's most recent opinion, and I've made it out in my brief, otherwise, in Roadmap, said there are two issues there. One issue is whether it was consensual, and the other issue is whether the consent was obtained by the illegal entry. And the court must answer both those questions, the trial court. Both those questions were not answered by the trial judge. She said the sole issue of consent. She was wrong. The trial lawyer submitted what I'd call a very interesting boilerplate memorandum. It did not contain the relevant law. It was one of these things some lawyers push off the computer. It didn't contain the law, which is set out in my brief, which demonstrates that opening up the door is not an invitation. It didn't cite all the cases, which says exactly what Villoba says. So there should have been an evidentiary hearing here. And the government says, well, you know, my other issue was ineffective assistance, not asking for 11A1, I forget the citation. They are wrong. First of all, ask the U.S. attorney if the government ever rejects that type of plea offer. They always go along. And two, if they didn't agree to go along, any competent lawyer would have simply said, fine, we want to raise this issue. Bring us to trial. We'll do nothing, judge. We'll sit here. We won't make opening statements. We won't cross-examine witnesses. We won't do arguments. We won't give them jury instructions. And the defendant in that case gets acceptance of responsibility because he's not disputing the facts except for the Fourth Amendment violation. And that doesn't happen because the government always goes along with those type of pleas. Finally, we get to the most important issue in this case, and it's important not only for my client, but it's important for the administration of justice. The government cites a number of cases and says, I may be paraphrasing them, that you can never have ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to move to suppress, even if the motion to suppress would have been successful, because it's not causing an unreliable result. That position, which was taken by a number of seven cases, and I don't know if Your Honor were on those cases or not, is absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong, number one, because it's a contrast of what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Morrison. If you look at, if I may read, and I hate to read a quotation to the court, but it's necessary. The majority opinion specifically said, we also reject the suggestion that criminal defendants should not be allowed to vindicate through federal habeas corpus reviews their right to effective assistance of counsel where counsel's prior error is failure to make a timely request for the exclusion of illegally seized evidence. Evidence, which the court admits, is typically reliable and often the most pertinent information bearing on innocence of guilt. But the court goes on to say, We have not imitated,
not imitated. I can't read the word.
Initially, T-I-M-A-T-E-T, it's 65, I can't read them.
Intimated, yeah.
Right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. That the right to counsel is conditioned upon actual innocence. The constitutional rights of a criminal defendant, of criminal defendants, are granted to the innocent and the guilty alike. Consequently, we decline to hold either of the guarantees of effective assistance of counsel belong solely to the innocent, or that attaches only to matters affecting the termination of actual guilt. That specifically rejects those other cases, seven certain cases, and specifically rejects the government's position here. And there's a very good policy reason, if I may explain to the court. This court, and I'm going to put obligations on the court, I'm sorry to say that, but I believe that you gentlemen who reach this high position have obligations not only into an individual case, but obligations to the law. This court has an obligation to see that there existence of effective assistance of counsel, that we don't have. And I don't mean by that you have to be a terrible lawyer to be ineffective. It's just you have made some terrible decisions, okay? You know, you didn't do the work on this case, okay? You didn't do it right. But this court has an obligation to see that there's a high standard of counsel. If the government's position prevails on that issue, you're not doing that. You're not doing that because the law in this state and most states is that the defendant can only sue a bad lawyer, okay, and collect a judgment if the defendant is acquitted. If he's convicted, you can never get a judgment, so you can never do anything. The community can never do anything to sort of make sure lawyers are effective. What that means is that people could be running around being as sloppy as they want to and there is no penalty for it. They can't be sued civilly because with their position, even though the defendant would have been acquitted, let's take a case where it's no doubt they break into somebody's house without a warrant, they kick down the door, they get a statement from him or they get physical evidence from him. Doesn't mean a thing, he didn't make the motion. It's bad public policy. And this court should look at that public policy in making its decision. In fact, you're obligated to look at it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Mr. Shirin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm going to address some of the issues Mr. Cohen raised, but I have to begin, Your Honors, with issues that he did not raise, and particularly the procedural posture in which this case finds itself before Your Honors. This case comes before you on a plea of guilty, in fact, two individual pleas of guilty by the defendant, one on count one and one that was made shortly thereafter on count two. In addition, both of these entries of guilty pleas were made with a waiver of any claim that the suppression holding of Judge Lefkoe was in error. The defendant did not preserve under 11A2, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11A2, any right to assert in this court that her very detailed and thoughtful opinion that she issued on the suppression motion, that it was in error. In other words, they took their shot in the district court, lost, and then packed it in on that issue. This, therefore, makes this case very different from Kimmelman, and this posture is a particularly appropriate posture for this court to continue to hold, as it now has held in a long line of cases that the failure to secure suppression of evidence, even if they could have secured suppression of evidence in this case, and in a moment I'll say why it's not a valid argument on the underlying merits. But even if it was a closer call in the district court, as Mr. Cohn suggests, it still can't amount to Strickland prejudice in this case after the defendant has already clearly indicated through his guilty plea that he is guilty. This is not even a case where a trial occurred after the suppression.
Well, that does distinguish it from the cases in which we recited the proposition you just mentioned. Those have been trial cases.
Exactly, Your Honor, but I think that cuts in favor of the government. In other words, there's nothing about the suppression hearing that in any way the judge's ruling on the suppression hearing that in any way tainted what followed in a trial. The defendant can't claim, I got an unfair trial because her suppression ruling was wrong, and my trial would have looked a lot different had she ruled correctly in my favor.
Sure, he could say, though, my guilty plea would have looked a lot different. I wouldn't have made it. Or if I would have made it, it would have vindicated by the vindication of the motion to suppress on appeal. I mean, that's what Hilligan. My trouble with your argument is I have a hard time squaring it with Hill against Lockhart. It seems to me that the Supreme Court's holding in Hill against Lockhart makes it clear that he can do exactly what he did here. He can enter. If he had gotten the right advice, he could have entered the guilty plea, conditional on the appeal of the suppression motion. And the providency of that, if he got bad advice in that respect, the providency of his plea is in question under Hill against Lockhart.
Well, Your Honor, that then would lead to the underlying challenge to Judge Lefkoe's holding. And in this case, the appellant has pointed to no evidence to undermine her carefully.
Okay, now I'm moving to another point. Now,
yes,
right?
I'm saying, yes.
Your backup point.
Yes, even accepting absolutely accepting Your Honor's position on Hill versus Lockhart without challenging it and moving to the next point, I would say that Judge Lefkoe issued a careful written opinion in which he has a precise, a detailed holding on the voluntariness of the consent. And really, that's her primary holding. It's only as a backup holding that she says, even if the consent had not been fully voluntary.
Her point being that the encounter was legal ab initio. So am I correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
The encounter between the law enforcement officers and the defendant at the door of the apartment was legal, was appropriate. Therefore, we don't need to walk down any further.
Exactly, that's correct. That's correct. And the reason she came to that conclusion is they asked him in Spanish, "May we enter?" And he opened the door for them, allowing them to come into the apartment, and at no point expressed any indicated that he was not giving the consent to their entry. And he used the sort of weasel words in his brief below, and the judge called the defendant on this, where he says, "Without invitation, I didn't invite them in, but they asked to come in. He fully gave consent, opened the door." That's very different.
Did he testify in English or Spanish?
He did not testify, Your Honor. This was done through an affidavit, and that was obviously in English. What transpired between him and his counsel in Spanish or English, we don't know.
As I recall, while he was looking at this consent paperwork, he saw somebody, one of the officers, already wandering around his apartment.
Your Honor, there's no dispute in this case that there was a when the officers first entered, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm blanking on the name of the word, a visual search of the apartment.
Usually, I think the euphemism is sweep.
Yeah, a protective sweep.
Yeah, protective sweep.
It's
inventory of what we might like to search.
Well, no, Your Honor, really the reason that a protective sweep is necessary is for the safety of the officers. They need to do a quick search to make sure that no one's hiding behind a couch or in another room. And in fact, that's particularly important in this case where, as it turned out, there was a loaded handgun underneath the couch right next to where Mr. Villegas opened the door for the officers. Mm-hmm. Yes. So there was a look around the apartment for the safety of the officers. As Your Honor,
because my concern is if that looks to the defendant like a sweep, does it vitiate? Why bother about the consent? He sees the search is going to go ahead anyway. That would certainly be the perception of the defendant.
Well, during the brief protective sweep here, Your Honor, there was no evidence spotted or seen. None of the evidence that was ultimately found, some was found in the rafters, some was hidden behind a back of a television, none of that was seen whatsoever in the protective sweep.
And that point, I don't believe, has been argued by counsel in any event, has it?
No, the protective sweep is not an issue before you.
No, or the inevitability of the
correct. The fact that an officer was in a protective sweep in any way affected his voluntariness. Indeed, there's no evidence, Your Honor, of any coercion or duress, and that was the principal.
Well, what other evidence did the district court consider besides the test of the on the search issue? There was testimony of the agent, I believe.
Your Honor, I believe she had before her a proffer of what the evidence would show, and in addition, there were attached to the opposition to the motion the police officer's report, a memorandum of the event that outlined paragraph by paragraph in detail the steps that the officers had taken, the response of the defendant, the fact that he had been given these questions in Spanish, the fact that the door had been opened for the officers. This is not at all like the cases cited by Mr. Cohn, where a defendant opens the door and the police officers rush in. That's not this case. This is a case where they say to him in Spanish, "We are DEA agents," show their badges, ask in Spanish, "May we have permission to come in?" And he opens the door. And this is certainly not a case in which guns are drawn, people are asked to lay on the ground, the door is broken down. So as to the Valencia point, I mean, I'm not even sure we need to get to the Valencia point because of the judge's clear holding about the consent and the voluntariness, the consent of the entry and the voluntariness.
That's your main point. That's
absolutely.
Yeah.
So on all those grounds, Your Honor, on both the longstanding holding in this court that the failure of the suppression of evidence in this case cannot amount to prejudice under Strickland, as well as the fact that the judge's underlying opinion is well analyzed, and there's been no evidence pointed to in the record or even proffered by the appellant before this court to suggest that holding was in error. And therefore, we would ask, Your Honor, to affirm the conviction and sentence of defendant Valais.
Okay. Mr. Cohn, you have 2 minutes.
Of course there's no evidence because there was no hearing. That's the complaint. There was the defendant's affidavit, which if the court would accept defendant's affidavit, if you look at page 7 of my brief, if you assume that the evidence was found to be as the defendant's affidavit, the sworn affidavit, was that, take paragraph 4, a fine opened the front door, two law enforcement agents entered into the apartment, crossing the threshold and passing through an open door into the living area, and a third law enforcement agent followed immediately behind the first two agents, and he also entered the living area of the basement apartment. Each of the three displayed credentials indicating police. The appellant did not invite any of the three agents in. And I go on with the other affidavit. If the trial court would accept the defendant's affidavit, he might win a motion to suppress. The state, what they submitted was the preliminary hearing transcript where the officer said some other things. It's a matter of conflict, of fact. You know, if you accept the government's statement of what the facts are, and as Castell says, which I cited in my brief, you can't resolve those conflicts without an evidentiary hearing. And that's what we're asking for here. And they said we didn't submit a proffer here. How can we submit a proffer of facts here in the Court of Appeals? One of the things I learned is you don't submit additional evidence in the Court of Appeals. Okay? There is a signed affidavit. Take a look at that signed affidavit and say, if those are the facts the judge would find, would there be a violation of his entry? And the answer is absolutely yes. So what has to happen in this case? It has to be sent back down for an evidentiary hearing. And you know, this is like a case where a judge enters a summary judgment. And I don't know much about civil law. I really don't. But I think what I remember in civil law
is that if there could be a factual dispute in the civil law, an entry of a summary judgment is wrong because it deprives the party of their hearing. This was an entry of a summary judgment, and it was wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cohn. Thank you, Mr. Shannon. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will...